I'm George Liston, CA. It is said that Americans are an ahistorical people, content with tableau-like representations of great moments. Valley Forge, Gettysburg, Iwo Jima, and the moon landing. If true, this is regrettable, particularly as it relates to African-American history, a people whose story has been both theme and counterpoint to the larger American saga since the country's first days. Without, for example, an understanding of the role of black organizations in advancing civil rights and gaining voting rights, vital chapters of the American Odyssey remain unknown and unclaimed, a loss for all. My guest is Diane Penderhughes, professor of political science and Afro-American studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and currently a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Diane, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George, for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. And, you know, as I was reading your work, I kept thinking that what you do provides context to the things that people often take as kind of vignettes. To be very specific, I thought of Rosa Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's now a legendary American story that she got tired and refused to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama, mm-hmm. and set off a major campaign. But Rosa Parks, one of the figures mentioned in the work that you have done, is, to use a Victorian phrase, a woman of parts, I mean, who belonged to organizations and was vitally mm-hmm. tied to things. So would you agree with that, Diane, that what you're about is to remind us that there are strong roots to everything that happened in 1965?
Oh, very strong, very mm-hmm. powerful. The phrase you used to describe Rosa Parks being a woman of parts is a very insightful one, because far too often I hear people describing her as the woman who got tired on the bus. Mm-hmm. Well, she was tired, but it didn't just happen that she therefore, because she was tired, took the action she did. It was because she was tired and because she had been an active member. She was a secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery. She was secretary also to E.D. Nixon, who mm-hmm. Was head of the NAACP, but was also a member of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
Absolutely.
And Parks had also been participated in a workshop at the Highlander Folk School, where she learned about how to actually interact with whites. Mm-hmm. At that time, people didn't have those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And to, in effect, role play and to push the boundaries was in and of itself a kind of an experience that allowed her to think about resisting
right.
someone white when she was on that bus.
Exactly, Diane. And that answer, and with her example, and the connections you made, the organizations, the fact that she's a woman, it's important mm-hmm. as well,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that she was connected with religious organizations, mm-hmm. and the mention of education are all mm-hmm. themes in what we're going to talk about. And what we're going to talk about, I think, also is important to note, has very deep roots. It's not just a factor of the post-Civil War, it's the post-Revolutionary War, isn't it, that we can look back to in terms of how African-American organizations were being formed. And maybe this is the most extraordinary thing about those organizations, Diane, to use a later phrase that applies to that time. They were formed by a people who, quote, had no rights that a white man was bound to respect. What was it like back in those early decades of the American Republic for African-Americans and organizations?
Well, in the early decades of the American Republic, the vast majority of the African-American population was enslaved. People were, you know, when I say the vast majority, we're talking, probably anywhere from 91% to 95% were in slavery for most of the decades before the American Civil War, which meant that they were, as the phrase you used from Justice of the Supreme Court, there were no rights that white man was bound to respect. People were in slavery. It's important to say almost right away, even those who weren't in slavery, which, as I've said, was a very small proportion, weren't guaranteed any protection.
Yeah.
They could have been, quote unquote, legally free, but the society didn't, that freedom was not a stable
exactly.
Position.
You know, that's exactly true, Diane. And one of the points you make in that regard, I think, is worth of a lot of emphasis, that what we're talking about and we'll be talking about are organizations obviously formed by individuals coming together for certain purposes,
mm-hmm.
but organizations derive their status from the status of their members, and these were people definitely without status. And to accomplish goals and not have status, I mean, that itself is an extraordinary undertaking.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an important insight that I think is so often lost when mm-hmm. we look at what the African-American community in general and what their organizations have been able to achieve over the last
right.
centuries.
Let's talk about the organizations specifically, and from the early days forward, the church organizations mm-hmm. have a big role to play mm-hmm. then and now. They didn't spring full-blown in the mid-1960s. They were there in the early 1800s. What was their role like, Diane? And perhaps even more to the point, what was the role of their clergy like in what they did?
Well, the founding of religious organizations really goes to the birth of the American democracy, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. When you look at some of the earliest churches and denominations, they were in existence at the same time as, in some cases, before the founding of the American Republic. The one that's probably the oldest is the African Methodist Episcopal Church as a denomination, mm-hmm. members of whom attended Methodist Episcopal churches in Philadelphia in the 1790s. And because there was a move to discourage people from sitting in the regular seats, they were being forced to move up and back, back and up either way, but out of the same space as the rest of the white congregation. The founding members of the leaders of the African Methodist Episcopal Church,
Reverend Allen,
walked out, founded the African and Methodist Episcopal Church mm-hmm. in Philadelphia as a single church, but mm-hmm. then later became a denomination. And those churches, that church as well as others, became the centers of religious but also political activity. You know, the fact that you have
yeah.
the church founded as a walkout around the issue of race uh-huh. meant that Allen and others served as the leaders of the convention movement in the 19th century. My point being, you mentioned the early 1800s. In fact, the founding of the Black Church goes back to the founding of the American Republic and then kind of follows along in terms of political and social issues, the status of the African American population.
Black women and black women's organizations. I want you to tell us a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sense that well, I guess I don't know. I have to confess ignorance as to when and where and with what strength they first became mm-hmm. visible and important. I certainly do think of them in terms of the turn of the century and sororities and so forth coming mm-hmm. into being.
Mm-hmm.
But as they came into being, very much like the churches, they were more than for just one purpose. It wasn't just a social mm-hmm. get-together, although I think the women were largely upper middle class or middle class
mm-hmm.
black women. But tell us about them and what those organizations, black women's organizations, meant then and now to civil rights and voting rights.
Okay. In my work that I'm doing, I've focused on women's organizations beginning in the late 19th century because I want to address the organizational foundation for legislative success in the 1960s, 1950s and 1960s. And to do that, I've looked back at the founding of a number of women's organizations, social clubs, civic organizations, the so-called women's club movement, which mm-hmm. began in the late 1890s when the society was undergoing a period of a kind of rejection of some of the conclusions and organizational changes that had been implemented after the Civil War. I'd never put those things together before, but actually mm-hmm. in 1895 is when the National Association of a couple of different groups came together, the National Association of Colored Women, we'll call them, because there were a couple, and they eventually joined together. And I think that actually occurred in 1895, right, mm-hmm. the year before the Plessy v. Ferguson decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And a lot of these women's groups were oriented specifically towards addressing the way in which the society viewed black women. And the way in which society viewed black women at that time was typically to degrade, to treat and to describe them as not respectable or respectful of American values. They wanted to emphasize the extent to which African-American women not only met but more than surpassed any set of values that America wanted to raise. And so I'm, of course, going to forget all the names of the women, but a number of them were engaged in forming organizations, really forming national affiliations. The organizations had existed around the country, but they weren't necessarily nationally linked.
Right.
And so the national linkage really came into focus in the late 1890s. I'm confident that there were plenty of such circles of women around the country from, well, for whenever.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I like that depiction immensely. Let me supply a name or two.
Okay, thank you.
Let me supply a name. I'll choose one not easily recognizable. Mm. You know, I could say Ida Wells Barnett, but there should be a lot of people who know who she was.
Right.
But let me choose someone who came to me as a great surprise. Maggie Lena Walker.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
1903. This woman is the president of a bank in Richmond, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Now, that should say quite a lot right there.
Mm-hmm.
But was she typical of what we're talking about, the women of great achievement against great odds who were...
I don't think Maggie Lena Walker could be described as being typical because... Mm-hmm. I believe, once again, I think she was the first woman to be president of a bank. Not the first black or the first black woman,
but the first woman
to be president of a bank. That bank still exists, by the way.
In Richmond.
In Richmond, yes. And her house...
What's it called?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know the name of the bank. Uh-huh. I should, but I don't know. But her house is actually a National Historic Site at this point, run by the National Park Service. But Walker belonged to and became head of an association of women that included men that addressed the economic status of women, created the bank was, I believe, related to it. Also, I think, participated in a boycott of the streetcars in Richmond in the 19-teens.
On the basis of them being segregated?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And was a person who was able to lay down a number of structures that allowed people to collaborate and try to address their economic status.
Yeah.
And I have to thank Professor Elsa Barkley Brown of the University of Maryland, who's done a good deal of research on Maggie Lena Walker and for even introducing her to me. But Walker is a really important figure in that respect.
And an atypical person in every regard.
Mm-hmm.
But an African-American woman that deserves emphasis, who did something no one else had ever done.
Mm-hmm.
In this regard, and thinking of her and perhaps others whose careers may not have been so spectacular, but who were in the organizations and who were middle or upper middle class women of achievement, here's the question. How did they relate or did they relate well to their sisters who may not have had those advantages? I guess I'm talking about class.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. There were tensions, without question. These are women who at that period were more likely to be educated in the sense that they probably had mostly attended high school at least. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they might have attended college. And many of them did attend college.
Right.
Some of them, beginning the early 20th century, had began to complete graduate degrees. And so they had a different position because there were so few African Americans who had achieved any education. Mm-hmm. And put that in the context of most of the population is in the South, most is in the rural South. After the Civil War, people are sharecroppers. The whole structure of the sharecropping system means you work whenever the crops need to be produced. And so while there were schools paid for out of the tax dollars of African Americans, but those schools were not operating on a year-round basis, or certainly not even as many months out of the year as schools for white kids. And they usually stopped after grade school. So most of the population at most would have gone to elementary school. There were no high schools for African Americans until the early 20th century in most of the South. You might have had in a city like Atlanta or a city like even St. Louis, there might be one high school for African Americans. In a city like Washington, D.C., where there were in the early 20th century two or three high schools for blacks in a segregated system, And I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my mother did as well, and I heard her talk about, you know, the high schools. And I always took that for granted. I didn't know until I was teaching at the University of Illinois and listened to my colleague Jim Anderson talk about the education of blacks in the South. That's the name of a book that he wrote on precisely this subject and where I learned these materials, that the average community in the South did not have high schools. So this puts into context these women who would have finished high school, in some cases finished college, and in other cases graduate school, to say they are among – they're not among the talented 10th. They're among the talented 1% of the population in the early 20th century.
Much to talk about, Diane. Let me take a moment, though, from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest is Diane Penderhughes, professor of political science and Afro-American studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and currently a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Let me try a proposition, Diane, to see if it makes sense, and you can accept or reject it, and we'll go from there.
Let me make one addition to our previous discussion. The organization that Walker not founded but helped reconfigure so that it became very successful was something called the Independent Order of St. Luke.
This is Maggie Lena Walker?
Yes, in Richmond. Now, I still haven't remembered the name of the bank, but that is the name of the organization.
You're forgiven. I'd like to move us to the 1950s and pose the question this way, and think in terms of the Montgomery bus boycott, where we have, and here I'm trying to unite in one question major themes, I think, of your work. We have coalitions of organizations, a man-based voting rights activity, women's organizations, the role of Rosa Parks, all coming together. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if this, in a sense, is the high watermark of of all these things, or one of them. I mean, how would you characterize it? How would you characterize that moment? Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting question.
Because we have the churches, we have the women's groups, we have Rosa Parks, and et cetera. And, you know, and what does it mean?
I don't think I would characterize it as the high watermark. I think what it is and what it does represent is the maturation of the organizational infrastructure that made the civil and voting rights legislation possible in the 1950s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Because it's right at that moment in Montgomery that you're right, you do see all of those components of the coalitions together operating collaboratively and in the same direction, which is fairly infrequent in American history, in African-American history, however you want to characterize it. Of course, the case that these are complicated areas of policy, so it's difficult to get people in agreement. This is one of those times when there was pretty good agreement, enough so, and the issue was framed in such a way that people were able to move in the same direction. Even in the midst of that, of course, there were differences about other specific policy areas. But I think that you're right to point to it as an important time because it's a city. First of all, it's a city. It's not a small town. It's a city that's complex enough to have a relatively complicated economic infrastructure in the African-American population. You know, it's not a few churches. There are a lot of churches. They even had, as you mentioned, there's a specialized women's group, something called the Women's Political Caucus, of which, I don't know whether Parks was a member of it. She was certainly linked to the women involved in it, but there was a specialized group of which Robinson is the last name of the person who was president of it, who had developed the plan for the boycott so that when something occurred, they had prepared and they thought about what they would do when someone was arrested because they had been encountering this for a number of years. Mm-hmm. They thought about how to address it and how to respond to it.
Right.
And it was that group that really, we hear about it. Rosa Parks got tired one day. She sat down. She wouldn't get up. And then people just boycotted. Well, no, that wasn't what happened. Mm-hmm. She'd been herself immersed and enmeshed in a complex network of civil rights organizations. And some of those other organizations had developed a set of contingency plans for what they would do when someone was arrested that they felt they could respond to. And I'm posing it in just that way because There was a young woman who was arrested, I think, a couple of years before, and whom they decided not to strike for because of the fact that she was a young woman who had was a teenage mother. She was not married. They didn't feel they could unite the community around it, nor did they feel they could defend her against the inevitable criticism that would arise from the white community if they chose to strike and boycott in defense of this person. And, you know, there are obviously contradictions about this and all sorts of problems, but they made a set of choices.
I'm glad I asked the question. And even if the term high water mark might not be the best term, from what you said, this
is a good one.
No, it's clearly an example. That's what I love about it. It's a conflation, if you will, of the organizations, the complexity, the fact that all this had roots, that strategies were worked out, and that different people coalesced around those strategies, whatever their other differences might have been. And it really points up the role of your work, which, I mean, the theme of your work, which is the role of black organizations with strategies in place and moving on them. To contrast that, and because our time is unfortunately all too brief, I want to move us to 1976, when we get a different phenomena. Something called the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation comes forth. Now, I don't know much about it, I'll be honest, but it just seemed to me, from what the little I did learn, that it was concerned with black voter alienation. And I found that very interesting because on the one hand, we have the Montgomery fervor and all of everything else that went into 1965 and voting rights. And but 1976, well, I guess this is the question. Were things changing and becoming more diffuse and different or getting less defined?
I think that by the 70s, you have the successes of gesturing for quotation marks, successes of the civil rights movement. You have the disappointments almost immediately afterwards, which were manifested in the riots of the mid-60s. You've had several assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the Vietnam War, both the success and the failure of Lyndon Johnson, who did not run for office a second time and therefore opened the presidency up to another possibility, which became Richard Nixon, the defeat of the Democratic coalition. So I would say that I don't know that I would say failure is involved in the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation. My understanding of it and is that it was created and attached to the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies is what it's called now. At that point, it was the Joint Center for Political Studies, created in the early years of the 1970s, I think, is when it first came into existence and intended to both supply information to help train the new class of black elected officials. And as part of that, they created this entity, the National Coalition of Black Voter Participation, served as an organization of organizations to try to get people to vote. Now, it was a voter mobilization organization, and it has a very similar structure to the Montgomery Improvement Association or these other kinds of organizations of organizations. You bring, except it was in the national level, it was positioned in Washington, but using the NAACP, the National Council for Negro Women, the a range of black organizations to move people to the polls. It's now a separate entity and has a somewhat different name, whose name, of course, I'm going to forget or don't remember at this point. But it does still exist. The organizational descendant exists. And one of its early executive directors is now serves on the board of a new commission created to generate black participation as well, but it's a national, federal government level organization entity.
Diane Pender Hughes, as we come to the conclusion of at least this conversation, in a way, this is the obvious question, and yet it's also, to my mind at least, an extremely important, perhaps even a fascinating one, and that is clearly where things are now and where they're headed in terms of black organizations, civil rights, voting rights, and issues. And I guess what, in the brief time we have here, I'd love to get your views on is in these early years of the 21st century, as these organizations, like all organizations, strive to retain relevance and effectiveness, will they necessarily have to look at issues like globalization, like collaboration with other groups, and even as our ethnic demographics change internally? I'm just thinking, I guess, must they now meet modern times in that sense?
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. They've got to function internationally. Given the way we see economic development occurring, lots of corporations are producing across national boundaries. Labor markets move people across boundaries all the time. The heterogeneity of our population, which for so many years was prevented from becoming more heterogeneous by racially based immigration laws. And now the boundaries have been opened up considerably, which means the African American community is becoming much more international in the United States. I mean, it's not that it wasn't previously, but we have the possibility of much more immigration, the reality of much more immigration that's begun over the last 20 years than was ever possible previously. So, yes, I think African American organizations have to have an international focus. Some participated in the Durban conference on racism and international discrimination that occurred in Durban, South Africa in 2001. They also have to, and do to a certain extent, I think, work collaboratively with racial and ethnic organizations all the time. And in fact, when you look at the voting and civil rights coalitions, they have a very broad base that involves multiracial national interest organizations. Mm-hmm. So without that capacity, I think African Americans will be isolated. I don't think they are, but we still have more work to do in that area.
Diane Pender Hughes, thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Diane Pender Hughes, professor of political science and Afro-American studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.